Hello and welcome to another episode of Follow the Sounds this week in music history. Our good, fearless leader, Mr. Brian Kroc, is out this week. He is in New York City, so instead, I am Greg Harvey, and along with me is Jacob Crump.
Good evening, Greg.
And our special guest tonight, Calamity Cole Duggar.
Yeah.
Welcome. How does it feel to have your first time in here, Calamity Cole?
I like these microphones.
Hey, yeah, you sound loud and clear.
Thank you.
Hopefully the listeners out there hear you loud and clear as well. And so, as you may already be familiar with, on this show, we take you through all the big historical events in music history that happened this week in time. So, without any further ado, let's just get right into it. We are doing November 6th through November 10th this week, and not so much a long list of stuff we're doing, but just kind of a little more in-depth stuff with particular events from those days. So with that being said, let's kick it off November 6th, Jacob Crumb.
All right, here we go. 1954, Elvis Presley records his first and last commercial. Now, in the early 50s, one of the most popular radio shows in the American South was Louisiana Hayride. The show was broadcast live from Shreveport Municipal Memorial Auditorium.
Auditorium.
Originally, it catered to established acts and contemporary country music fans. However, after a series of very interesting scandals we will not be getting into in the 1940s, it saw the arrest and imprisonment of several members of Hayride's board, LSU, that's Louisiana State University's president, James M. Smith, and the superintendent of Louisiana, all involved in a scandal with some stupid radio station. Can you believe it?
Wow.
Anyway. They came under new management, and the current head honcho, Horace Logan, was kind of tired of playing second fiddle to Nashville's Grand Ole Opry, and he decided to focus on a younger audience. The emergence of a new act with crossover appeal that would be Johnny Cash helped bring in new sponsorship, and one of those was Southern Made Donuts. So it was only natural that the big names that were on Louisiana Hayride would endorse the sponsors. Johnny Cash recordings have been saved for prosperity. You can find those on Louisiana Hayride's Greatest Hits, Compilation 1 and 2.
Is it literally like Johnny Cash being like, get yourself some Southern Made Donuts?
He sings the jingle. They had a jingle. He sings it. The problem is, Elvis's version of the jingle has been lost to time. I can only imagine how much that would be worth today. I'm sure everyone would run out and buy a copy.
Well, get yourself a donut. Get a little hole, cram it in your mouth.
He recorded that one commercial, but then did a couple like live readings. And okay, I have this like a feud that's been going for years as to what Elvis's favorite donut is with a friend of mine, and I say it's a jelly donut.
Yeah.
He tries to tell me it's a Bavarian. That's a chocolate ice cream filled.
Ooh, yeah.
If we found those recordings, we could probably solve it.
Oh, yeah, the part where he goes, and this one's my favorite.
Yes.
And then just static. Oh, man.
I would die. I would literally die if I found that recording and the name of the donut was the only thing that didn't survive. I would literally die.
So you're telling me that they don't make, like, peanut butter and banana donuts?
I don't know. I don't even know if Southern Made Donuts is still a thing. It's like one really easy Google foo away. But.
That's true. Well, I don't know what to say about Elvis's donut endorsement, but I'm sure it was a delicious one, just like the man's career.
If they had a peanut butter and banana donut, that would be my thing.
Yeah?
Those sandwiches are great.
Yeah. I mean, would it be like a glazed donut with peanut butter just smeared on it, and then, like, bananas on top?
I don't know. Now that you say that, it kind of reminds me of, like, the Grizzly Stadium. It's a special sandwich. It's, like,
the Gateway Grizzlies here on the east side, yeah.
Yeah, it's a sandwich, but with a glazed donut cut in half, and then it's, like, sausage, egg, and cheese type thing inside of it. I don't know if that's the exact thing inside, but it's a sandwich like that.
Well, we're not Elvis, but we certainly are doing some endorsements for the for the donut burger over at the Gateway Grizzly Stadium.
Okay.
That sounds good.
Southern Made Donuts is still a thing.
Oh.
They do not have a peanut butter banana donut.
Darn.
I do, however, see a green tea donut, which I'm going to pass on.
Gross. Actually, that might be okay. I don't know. I tried. So my girlfriend went to Trader Joe's and she got some green tea ice cream. And like it was weird. Like the first taste was weird, but then I just ate the whole thing. It was really, it was good. I don't know. It's so strange because it tastes like tea at first, but then it kind of smooths out with the cream and it's, I don't know. It's good. Well, anyways, moving forward to the year 1968, The Monkees and their film Head debuts. Columbia Pictures and NBC had expected a lighthearted musical adventure, and somehow the actors themselves were able to convince the powers that be that they should hire the same crew from Easy Rider to do the Monkees movie. Well, it was an easy sell considering that what a smash the Rebel film had been the previous summer. So we knew these guys, you know, knew what they were doing, essentially. Sometime in the winter of 67, the Monkees, along with writer and director Bob Rafelson, is that it?
Yes.
Rafelson. And, of course, then writer Jack Nicholson, locked themselves in a cabin in Ojal, I believe is the name of that town? Yeah, right. O-J-A-L. I believe it looks like Ojal.
It's pronounced Rancho Cucamonga.
Right. But out in a cabin in California, essentially, with a large bag of the devil's lettuce. And they pressed a record on a reel-to-reel tape recorder. Nicholson spent a month turning the stream of consciousness ramblings into a script. And principal photography began on February 15th, 1968. Now, a one-day walkout protest took place on the first day of shooting when Mickey Dolenz, David Jones, and Michael Nesmith found out that due to the fact that when they were not in the Writers Guild, they would not get a writer's credit on the film. But, I mean, they're going to get acting credits, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyways, so they walked out nonetheless. Peter Tork was upset but stayed on the set for the day. Early the next morning, a renegotiation took place, and each was given a writer's worth of profits in agreement to continue the film. Hey, go figure, get paid to do it. Wow. The writers didn't share. The writer's share didn't really matter much because the film bombed, and even with its cult status now, has yet to make its budget back. So basically, Monkees film was a flop, and people had an issue with not getting paid, but then it was a flop. So that sucks.
Have either of you seen Head?
Nope.
No, have not.
It's really weird. There's a lot of interesting cameos in it that are kind of worth, like, you're like, oh my God, why is Joe Frazier in here? I don't know, but he's there. And at the end of the movie, they all jump off a bridge and commit suicide.
Is there a storyline leading up to that?
Doesn't make any sense. It's just a collection of, like, kind of how people felt about things in the 60s.
About how they felt about the Monkees?
Not really.
About how Jack Nicholson felt about A Cabin in the Woods?
Yes. Yes, very much.
He wrote a script where the Monkees kill themselves.
Yeah, there's a lot of like anti-war sentiment in it. And it was just not what NBC and everyone was expecting. They wanted the Hard Day's Night version of the Monkees. And instead they got what was the John Lennon movie where he was a soldier that was unintelligible and insane?
Cue all the people screaming at your podcast, right? This happens every time. There's somebody there like, you guys, it's this. It's this one thing. Gosh. Well, why don't we Google it real quick? Go on.
But anyway, it was more like a version of that where just didn't make any sense to really anyone, even the people that were making it at the time.
Even they look at it and are like, what were we thinking?
Yeah, absolutely. Michael Nesmith is like, I can't believe I tried to act. Davy Jones was like, you know, I probably could have made more money doing something else. Peter Tork was like, I was along for the ride. And Mickey Dolenz was like, you know, I had fun. I had a good time.
It was weird, but it's kind of fun.
Yeah.
I'm wondering which one it is here. When I just Googled John Lennon movie, comes up with Imagine, John Lennon, 88.
No, it was like my Boy in the War or something.
Huh. There's the U.S. versus John Lennon. Nowhere Boy? Is that it?
No. It literally doesn't matter because it's garbage.
Okay.
Like, how I won the war.
How I won the war.
That's what it
okay.
was.
Okay. See, I want to have answers. I don't like to leave the listeners wondering and be like, go do your own research there, listener. No, that's what we're here for. It's to provide the answers that
well,
people
you've got all the answers the on the page that you're going to need with less typos, might I add.
Okay.
That was a Herculean effort getting through the notes I had given you, by the way, on that one.
I know.
I don't pre-read these at all, Cole. I don't know if you noticed.
I feel a little guilty that I read the whole story and then I say, no, I haven't seen the movie, but it's true. But right. I do have the notes to let you know. And with that being said, let's move on, huh? 1975 is the year the Sex Pistols play their first show at St. Martin's School of Art. They open for Bazooka Joe. The lead singer for Bazooka Joe was Stuart Goddard. Stuart credits the Sex Pistols as the inspiration for his onstage persona, Adam Ant. Boom! There you go. And if you're unfamiliar with Bazooka Joe's music, maybe you heard of Madness cover the song Rockin' in A-flat and One Step Beyond. So there you go. See, I can read. When I see uppercase A, lowercase B, I know that you're saying A-flat.
I know.
Ooh, you thought I was going to get tripped up there,
no,
too.
No, well, I really wish that I knew my Windows alt codes better.
Yeah.
So you can have the little symbol.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But I wasn't going to look it up. I was just typing out, you know, it was like whatever.
And you weren't going to type A-F-L-A-T.
No, I wasn't going to do that. That's five more keystrokes than I need, Cole. Come on.
I know, we've already got three pages of notes.
I know.
So this was essentially the day that Adam Ant kind of became Adam Ant.
Yeah.
In a way, because the inspiration he got to open for this day. And then later on went to say that, yeah, the Sex Pistols is kind of the reason why I did the whole Adam Ant thing.
Mm-hmm. So,
that's the day. That's the moment.
I want you to imagine for a moment.
Close your eyes.
That you are on stage at the St. Martin School of Art.
Okay, I've been there a million times.
You are playing in a band called Bazooka Joe.
Yeah.
And you're trying to summon everything that's good about the U.S., on the stage. You've written songs, you've practiced songs, you've rehearsed, right? You go on to play your set and the crowd doesn't care. Why does the crowd not care? Because before you got on stage, a band that couldn't play their instruments just brought the house down. Wow. Of course you're going to become Adam Ant after that. There's nowhere else to go.
Well, at that point, you just change your name.
Yeah, are you going to apply yourself and learn your instrument better? No!
No.
No, you're going to put on eye makeup and you're going to change your name to something weird and be a weirdo.
This is America, damn it. Yeah. You can reinvent yourself.
Cool. There you go.
Well, speaking of people who have alternate personas, this next one, a little more recent, we're going to send it over to my man Cole, Calamity Cole.
All right. The guy who's reinvented himself how many times?
Oof. Who, me or you?
No, Ozzy Osbourne.
Oh, what did he do this time?
Okay, in 2015, Ozzy Osbourne returned to the Alamo. Now, his previous visit was in 1982, and, well, it wasn't quite the biting the head off a bat, but urinating everywhere. So,
yeah. Oh, man. Yeah.
Really, Ozzy?
You know, I feel like he's really lucky that he didn't urinate on the Alamo in 2015, or to this date, for this matter, because as you may recall, that was the moment where everybody was like, oh, Ozzy Osbourne is, you know, a traitor and, you know, un-American, even though he's not American anyways. But, he peed on the Alamo, and I'm surprised they ever let him back.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it took a little more than 30 years.
Yeah.
Almost 40 years.
He's just lucky to have lasted that long, I suppose.
All right. And hey, in his defense, like, those kinds of places in Europe have government officials that stand outside and guard the place.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know if you've ever seen the Alamo. It's just tucked away in, like, a strip mall. There's just urban encroachment
really?
All around it. Yeah.
It's just
like
there.
You're walking down the street and you're like, oh, hey, there's a Tim Hortons. And over there, there's a that. And look, hey, I could, like, you know, buy a muffler from this place in Alamo.
That's where Jim Bowie died. Yeah. Right here in the middle of this strip mall.
Pretty much. Or what's left of the Alamo, I should say.
Oh, man. Man, that's one place I would love to go, though. The Alamo. And I swear to God, I will not piss on it either when I go.
So. If you gotta go, you gotta go.
I mean, yeah, you know, they should. I think since then they put in like at least a porta potty in the parking lot or something. So, well, it's a new day, friends. Let's move on. November 7th.
November 7th, the Beatles play the Adelphi Cinema in Dublin. Is that how you say that? Adelphi?
That works.
Okay.
I think there's supposed to be a little bit of an Irish accent, but yeah, go
yeah,
on.
Yeah, I'm a terrible person for accents.
The Adelphi Cinema.
So, yeah, that is their only performance in Ireland. Just a few months later, they came to America.
Yep. Yes. But so, can you
that
believe
that was in
it's...
1963.
Their only show.
Their only the, show in Ireland. Yeah. Hmm. Well, because they weren't even famous yet. And then they didn't. I mean,
are you saying that Ireland's not worth playing if
well,
you're
I'm
famous,
just saying
or?
That, like, they probably should
You'd
have
think
gone
they'd
back
go
to Ireland
back, yeah.
A bunch of times.
I don't know, man. Like, I started thinking about this after, like, after I typed it out, and, you know, there was a lot of, like, domestic terrorism
was
while the Beatles were the Beatles in what? Ireland. So maybe there was good reason
yeah,
not to go there.
Yeah, good reason.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and that's the subject I don't know as much about, but there's been a long history of that tension between Ireland and England, and this mm-hmm. probably could have been, like, you know, when a lot of that was in the thick of it,
yeah,
too. Because I listen to, like, the Craig Ferguson show a lot. I know this is a tangent, but he was just talking the other day, because he's from Scotland, mm-hmm. and he was kind of giving a little rundown of the history, you know, of Ireland and Northern Ireland and Wales and Scotland and on all that. And, even he was recalling that, you know, somebody said something about, like, how have you never gone to Ireland and this and that? And Craig Ferguson, who, you know, is, like, what, in his 50s? And he was like, oh, yeah, growing up, like, you know, you couldn't really go to Ireland or vice versa because of all the terrorism. And, yeah, that was a crazy time. So, anyways, that was the year 1963. 1974, though.
Yes, it's time for news in the unsubstantiated.
Yes, from the wild.
Yes, from the wild. 1974, Ted Nugent is named the national squirrel shooting champion after a supposed kill on a squirrel with a bow at an approximate 150 yards.
Nice. That's a long shot.
That's a really long shot with a bow at a squirrel.
Bow, yeah. How do you get the squirrel to sit still
know.
That long?
But what I do know is that the National Squirrel Shooting Championship has zero internet presence, if it exists at all.
It's not even a real thing.
Yeah, so I got this from several sources. They didn't ever, like, put a link or say this is where this came from or have a story or talk about an article. They just simply had this listed as a fact.
It's a thing. Only yeah. in 1974 they had this championship.
If you go to his Wikipedia page, you can confirm it there. That's the most credible source on the matter. Well, congratulations, Ted Nugent, for in 1974 killing a squirrel with a bow over 1.5 football fields away.
If that happened, that is amazing. I don't think it did.
That actually is pretty impressive.
Yeah.
All right. Well, moving on.
2001. Kind of a sad day that turns into a strange day and then an even sadder story.
Okay. Give me the bad news first.
Okay. The bad news is that on this day, 2001... the wife of Rod Lawrence Skrunk, known for his only hit, If I Had a Girl, under the name Rod Lauren, was stabbed to death in her car outside of a shopping mall. She was a Filipino actress named Nadia Blanca. She married Rod in 1979, but the two had drifted apart. She went so far as to remove Rod's name from the deeds to pretty much all of her property and write him out of her will. Rod, now naturally after the murder, became the prime suspect. However, on November 19th, a man named Philip Meddle, came forward and confessed that Rob had hired him to kill Nadia. But 4 days later, recanted the entire testimony. So in January 2002, Rod left the Philippines to journey home and visit his mother, who was in hospice care. He remained stateside after her death and was officially charged with conspiracy to commit murder in 2003, but fought extradition successfully. And in 2004, charges were dropped. When the man who previously confessed, Philip Meddle, was officially charged with the murder of Nadia. Rod's story, however, comes to a very sad end when he intentionally jumped off a balcony at the Tracy Inn in 2007. Philip Meddle eventually died in prison in 2010. He was serving time on a completely different conviction because he was a complete shithead and never stood trial for Nadia's murder.
Wow. Okay. Well, there was a lot going on there.
But, yes.
So essentially, like any situation where somebody's wife gets stabbed to death, the husband is the prime subject or the suspect.
Yes.
But we don't know for sure if he hired a hitman because the hitman said that he was hired to kill her and then took that back.
Okay, so her sister wrote a biography like 2 years ago about Nadia. And, Nida. I keep saying Nadia. Nida. However, in the book, she said that she believed that Philip Metal was the killer and that he had concocted the story to blame Rod to try and get a reduced sentence by going in and saying, I'll cut a deal with you and I'll confess to this if you charge, because you would get a lightened sentence if you were cooperating. You know?
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Okay. So, well, I don't know what else to say except I guess I get it, but I'm a little bit confused.
I think everyone's a little confused on that one.
Yeah. Well, it's just weird. I don't feel like I've heard as much about, like, this definitely was not like an O.J. Simpson type
case. No, it wasn't. It was a case that drug on for a really long time, and that was part of the reason that the U.S. never extradited them to the Philippines, because they kept telling the PNP, the Filipino National Police Department, that they needed to get their act together because, like, the charges were, like, when they would request paperwork, it just would never get sent over, you know?
So, like, even to this day, there's a lot of questions left. Mm-hmm.
She was a really famous actress in her day. So, I don't know if the police department was just trying to wrap it up because they wanted to save face and they looked bad. I really don't know.
Well, we got one more fact for November 7th. And this is a complete opposite from what we just talked about. Because in the year 2015, Pentatonix becomes the first a cappella group to snag a number one album. It was their self-titled. Pentatonix, good a cappella.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I've heard a couple songs.
They actually are really good. Pentatonix, they have essentially, I would say, spearheaded the entire a cappella resurgence in modern time because, my girlfriend has a teenage daughter, and she is obsessed with Pentatonix. They absolutely love it.
Oh, so you know all about it.
Yeah, but, I mean, they're really good. And one of my favorite things is, like, if you like a cappella, you're really going to love them. But if you don't like a cappella, one of the edgier sides of it, too, is that somebody's always beatboxing and doing, like, the bass lines to their stuff.
Yeah.
And that guy who does that is dope. Because that's not easy to, like, I love trying to beatbox, maybe not successfully, but, like,
it's a hobby when you're driving home.
Yeah, for me personally, you know, a little bit of drumming on the steering wheel and trying to, like, beatbox. But,
yeah, I get it.
But, like, the fact that when you hear their music, besides the studio magic, it's all produced with people's mouths. And that's what can always kind of blow your mind is hearing the different, like, trumpets and they do an awesome cover of Bohemian Rhapsody, and they still get like the gongs, you know, like the gong hits and all these different notes in there. And just for the solos, it's just somebody like, wah, 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 wah. But like, they're just singing it. So Pentatonix, honestly, I'm not surprised they hit a number one album. And a cappella
now,
group.
Do they do originals too? Is it mostly covers?
I would say the majority is covers, you know, because...
Well, I mean, if you're going to do a cappella, you're going to have to do something with familiarity to attract an audience in the first place.
Yeah. Well, I think that's why they got so famous is because they were doing like viral videos and lots of covers and just stuff that, you know, you say all the time, Jacob, that about how it's just bad. There's no bad songs, just bad compositions.
Yeah.
And they do awesome compositions of songs. I mean, they can do... you know, Take On Me, or they could do, like, Rick Astley, Never Gonna Give You Up, but they would do, like, their version of it, and that's what makes them cool. So, I like it. Well, moving on to another great day in history, because my father was also celebrating his birthday on November 8th.
November 8th. There's a patent granted for the gramophone, and that was Emil Berliner. Is that how you say that?
That is
close
that,
enough
that's
again?
Good enough, yeah.
All right. He's the first to market it, although he wasn't the most successful. 3 years later, Victor Talking Machine Company becomes the largest producer of gramophones.
Boom, gramophones all up in your face. Yeah.
That's like where audio starts.
It was born. So 1887, yeah. Well, I mean, we already had the wax cylinders going from Edison, right, that were playing music. But I think this was probably the first mass-produced thing that you could purchase and have in your home to listen to music, like, commercially, wouldn't you say, Jake?
Pretty close, you know. That patent for the gramophone, or the gramophone in general, just, like, with the wax cylinders, the design of the needle and the diaphragm involved, there's a lot of material loss just in playing back,
right?
Mm-hmm. The media.
Well,
so
it's made of wax to begin with.
Well, that's kind of a misnomer. It's actually more like soap.
Okay,
that doesn't sound any better. But
no, not much. But have you ever seen the video of the guy on Tech TV shattering a wax cylinder while he's showing everyone? No?
No.
Oh,
yeah,
wow.
It's really terrible.
He just starts to cry.
Almost.
Oh.
There's like this really old just octogenarian, and he's showing everyone, you know, this is the technology. And they're kind of doing like a rundown of just recording technology through the years. And he's running his finger, and you can see his hands are shaking because he's really damn old. And it just breaks right in his hand.
Oh,
just
man.
Shatters this thing, and he just goes... Shit.
Yeah.
Darn.
I mean, yeah, I would probably too. Be like, damn these hands. Well, anyways, gramophones. I don't think the world, that's actually, I mean, when you think about the gramophone, is one of the few inventions for listening to music that we still utilize to this day, because now we just have record players that we actually have in 2017.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the speeds are different, the format's a little different, but it's the same principle.
Yeah, that concept being over 100 years old,
mm-hmm.
And we still actually do use that technology, even though we've come up with such, more advanced technology since then. So that's cool. Well, jumping ahead about almost 100 years as it is, what do we have next? 1947.
I love this because I love Minnie Riperton. So, born on this day, Minnie Riperton. Born Minnie Julia Riperton Randolph in Chicago, Illinois.
Happy birthday!
Minnie was known for her insane vocal ability, most notably her 5-octave range,
wow,
and absolute ability to shred in the whistle register.
Wow.
That high F that she phonates on Lovin' You is very rarely duplicated because there's only like a handful of people in a generation that can sing that note. I don't mean hit that note. Like you can whistle and scream and hit the note, but you can't phonate
it.
You can't
sing it.
Yeah, exactly. You can't make words when you're up there. You're just screaming like a dog whistle. Anyhow.
Lovin' You.
Now, beginning in 1976, she went through a very public treatment for stage 4 breast cancer and became a spokesman for the disease. Her last performance was on the Michael Douglas show, not the Michael Douglas, the Mike Douglas show, on June 15th, 1979. She died in her husband's arms in Cedars-Sinai, listening to a private recording from Stevie Wonder on July 12th, 1979. Her tombstone at Westwood Village Memorial Park Cemetery reads, "Loving you is easy, 'cause you're beautiful."
Oh, wow. Wow, so she went on, she did her last performance just a month before she passed.
Mm-hmm. She did not really have function over the right side of her body, so...
When she did the show?
Yeah, so when you watch it, she's just kind of has like the mic cable looped in her hand to make it, kind of like how Bob Dole holds a pen to make his, gimped up hand look natural.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
You know, she didn't quit touring, she was still doing shows.
Wow. Well... That high F note is very recognizable.
Oh, yes.
I don't know why. It makes me think of National Lampoon's Vegas Vacation when Goldie Hawn is like, she's like hanging out with Wayne Newton. And so Chevy Chase is getting all mad and she sings a song and hits that high note.
Mm-hmm.
his mouth just drops like, whoa, I might have a problem here. She might like Wayne Newton.
Have you ever been to a karaoke when someone's tried to sing Lovin' You?
Lovin' You!
No, like, I've heard several people sing it who had, like, you know, passably decent voices. Like, oh, you can sing. But then they get to that part of the song and they have to do something else or phone it in or just try and make it and give up.
Ooh.
Yeah, and I always, I completely, anytime that song, somebody starts to sing it, That if they hit that note, that's gonna be my night. Like, yeah. My night ends there.
If somebody hits that high F, you're like, shut it down.
Shut it down.
No one else is going for the rest of the night.
I'm buying drinks for that person, and I am a slave to that note. Every second, I'm going like, can I get that one more time?
We're done. Turn on the jukebox. Turn off the screen. Yeah. Nobody else sings.
I don't care if I've got the next song. It's over. We're gonna smash the equipment, burn the place down.
No more karaoke for anyone ever. No. Oh, man. Well,
we're shutting it down. We're moving on.
I know. I'm not holding my breath, though, until somebody hits that note. But I want to say right now, this next one, one of my favorite movies of all time. So with the mic in my hand, I want to pass it to Calamity Cole.
All right. Eminem becomes the first hip-hop artist to win the Oscar, or to win an Oscar with Lose Yourself from the film 8 Mile.
A booyah.
You love that film, don't you?
Yeah, this 2008 winning an Oscar for Lose Yourself. I've seen 8 Mile. Well, I own it, but it's the movie I've seen the most ever, actually. And I know that sounds really crazy, but I think it's a really good movie. I mean, those rap battles. It's good stuff.
You know, it's great. The music in it. I'm not like the biggest rap fan, but they're talented people, you know. It's talent and I appreciate it. I'm just not the biggest fan of the movie itself.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's all.
I think it's very overrated.
Well, you know, I think saying it's overrated is overrated. So
okay, that works. Agree to disagree.
That's good, but it is a good movie. Brittany Murphy, R.I.P., was in it. She had a nice performance. Eminem is as himself. That's pretty cool.
Well, I think it would have been a tall order to ask him to be anyone other than himself.
Well, I mean, you could have had somebody play.
Asking somebody else play him. Yeah. That would be a train wreck.
But that happens more often than not, you know?
In 2008, who would they have gotten to play Eminem? Like,
I can't even think of anybody.
It could have been anybody.
Could have been anybody, he says. I mean, Christian Slater was probably a little old to do it, right?
I don't know why. I don't want to think about the casting because, I mean, Eminem as himself. But the weird thing, though, too, is that it's like it's that kind of parallel where it's not like totally his story because they like change his name and pretend like he's a different person entirely. But yet it's still kind of based off of his life. So I don't know. But the music, I mean, the music's what brought me back to the movie so many times. And it won an Oscar. You know,
there you go.
I mean, so you know, that's a good start. I will say, as far as my argument goes for the good music in 8 Mile. So, anyways, why don't you go give it another watch, and let me know what you think after that. And in the meantime, we'll move on to our next day in history, November 9th.
50 years earlier than 2008. Let's make that 150 years.
Yes. Go on.
The New York Symphony Orchestra has their first performance.
Wow. Hey, that's pretty cool.
Have you guys ever been there?
No. I have not.
Man, if Brian Croc was here, he would launch into his story about how he was probably on the steps of the building where this absolutely happened. And he met an old man on the street who was there in 1858. Told him all about it.
Right. And then sang a song to him and gave him a harmonica. And then as he was leaving, a cat crawled out of the guy's jacket and waved bye to him. You know, something ridiculous.
Yeah. Some fantastic
story. He took his top hat off and there was a rabbit that jumped out.
Right. Yeah. But you know what? Brian Croc is not here, so you don't get that story. But what I do find interesting, though, is that the American Civil War started in 1861. And the New York Symphony Orchestra had their first performance in 1858, so 3 years earlier. So it always, I don't know, I guess it always fascinates me that the things such as this, because back up in Normal, Illinois, I know that Illinois State University was founded like 4 years before the Civil War as well. And so it's interesting that you would have something momentous like this start, and then we would be launched into a nation at war. And so something like the New York Symphony Orchestra actually managed to, you know, weather out something like that right away in New York City. And who knows, maybe even like Abraham Lincoln attended as one of his last things he did. Maybe even he might have seen him. I don't know, man. I'm getting really deep here. I don't know much about the New York Symphony Orchestra, so.
I don't know, but I do agree. It's pretty cool that, you know, they're not, they may not have been the most established business, and then we have a nation at war, and they managed to get through that.
Yeah. I don't know. Are we bullshitting right now?
No, you know, I mean, if you think about it, there's a nation at war, and you have a new business. How do you think that's really going to...
Well, yeah. I mean, I think it's just, how did...
Maybe that brought people together.
Well, yeah.
United the nation in New York.
And I guess my... Well, okay, so here's what I'm getting at here. Is that the Civil War happened after this. So, like, in the years leading up to the Civil War, I imagine there was probably a lot of tension. This was probably when the states were starting to secede from the Union, and, you know, we started to feel that divide and that division. And so just 3 years before the whole country was fighting itself, something like the New York Symphony Orchestra has their first performance. And so, yeah. Anyways, that's all I'm getting at, though, is that it probably was a very troubling time. And, you know, maybe that was one of the few things that people actually were able to kind of get away from the craziness and go and enjoy the orchestra. So there it is. There's the one phone call per show right there.
Yep.
That just called me. Hey, so moving ahead, 1967, Rolling Stone magazine. You guys ever heard of it?
Yes.
Yeah? Well, their first issue was published on this day in 67. You know who was on the first cover of Rolling Stone?
Tell me.
Tell me. John Lennon. Yeah. Articles focusing on David Crosby, The Who, and Country Joe and The Fish, all included in that first issue. I wonder how much the first issue of Rolling Stone is worth, if it's got like a dollar amount attached to it or something.
Oh, that's a good idea.
I know.
Yeah, look that up. Boy, yeah, you know what? That's good company to be in. David Crosby, The Who, Country Joe.
Yeah,
I have no idea.
I was going to say, do you know anything about Country Joe?
No,
and
I didn't want to come into this knowing anything about it.
Uh-huh.
I just wanted it to be there.
I see. Let's see. Value. I want to find out if you have a copy of... I like how when I Google the first issue and they're like, you can get Rolling Stone magazine for $17 a month, 26 issues.
We live in a world of advertising.
I guess. What is the value of the very first issue of Rolling Stone magazine with John Lennon on the front page? In mint condition, it's worth between $500 and $600.
Oh, okay.
Wow. Well,
I was expecting more.
They said in 2011 on an episode of Pawn Stars, they bought one for $300. But of course, they're trying to flip it for a profit. Mm-hmm. So that's pretty cool.
Sure. His first offer was $5.
Right. No. Yeah. His first thing he said, this is pretty cool, but I'm going to have an expert check it out before I really get into it. That's how it always is.
Gosh, oh, reality television.
Makes me want to rant on pawn shops because they take your possessions when you're at your most
vulnerable.
Desperate. Yeah, your most vulnerable, and they lowball you, and then they turn around and sell it for how much you should have sold it for, but you were too desperate to do so yourself.
So you're just like, pawn shop, I don't have time for eBay on this.
But Rolling Stone magazine, what a great magazine just to have a subscription to. It's interesting because in more recent times, they've been kind of getting into politics, and it's kind of divided a lot of people one way or the other on Rolling Stone magazine. But I mean, I feel like they've always really kind of just had to have a, you know, open conversation about not only the artists, but what the artists were trying to say as well. And this was a platform for people like John Lennon, not just to be, hey, it's John Lennon, the rock and roll legend, but here's the man, John Lennon, and here's what he's thinking and what he's feeling. And it was a great opportunity to really expose people, especially diehard music fans, to this whole other side of the music industry and these people that you grew up and loved. And I mean, a publication that's stood the test of time, though. That's amazing. 67. So they just had their 50th anniversary, huh?
Yeah.
Cool. Wow. Well, congratulations to Rolling Stone Magazine.
I believe they had a special issue, didn't they?
Yeah. Oh, of course.
I can't remember what it was, though.
Of course they did. Of course they did. Well, yeah. I would be interested in going and picking up that 50th issue. I wonder, actually, you know what? Okay, I'm curious again. Who would have made the cover if it would have been John Lennon again on the 50th anniversary issue? I know, right?
Mm-hmm. Good question. Robin Thicke.
Robin Thicke has a big, gosh, somebody I don't like. Okay, yeah. Well, I'll look up who's on the 50th anniversary here, and let's move on.
Yeah, all right. So on this day in 1990, upon hearing that IRS agents are on their way to his house, Willie Nelson mails his famous guitar Trigger to Maui. All the rest of his assets are seized for auction, including gold records, Willie's master tapes, and pretty much anything he had that wasn't on his back that was worth something.
Wow. So he just mailed the one thing?
Well, that's the one thing he's kept throughout all of his years.
Okay, so there's like three different stories as to how Trigger got to Maui. One of them is that he gave it to a friend, and his friend just drove to the post office and fucking mailed it. Which I think is how it probably happened. But yeah. So Trigger is a Martin N20 nylon string guitar with a Prismatone pickup. And if you wanted to get your own Trigger, it's going to cost you. Because neither of those are in production anymore.
Wow.
So if you want to get yourself like a 1960s Martin N20 and...
First off, it's a 1960s Martin guitar.
Yes. Right.
Good luck.
Good luck. Exactly. I hope that you're a very successful real estate agent or a hedge fund manager, because I don't know how else you could afford it. And that Prismatone pickup has been like... That thing has been out of production. I think they stopped making them in the 40s. Because the one that he had, he pulled out of the guitar, a guitar that broke. He was like, here, put this in it. This is the one I want.
Nice.
So, there is a Trigger 2 that they made up for him because his was in such bad shape. And he doesn't like
refuses
playing it.
Refuses to use it.
Yeah, he's like, I just don't like playing it.
I don't care if this one's got like a hole in it. And, yeah.
There, the guy who works on his guitar put up a, he just had his guitar in shop and has a YouTube channel and just put up like three videos of working on it.
That's
like
cool.
Re-gluing it with horsehide glue and stuff.
That's awesome.
It is. It's a really interesting look because it's the only time I've ever seen inside the guitar.
Right.
Because he sticks
He's
a camera down
camera,
in it.
The camera, yeah. That's cool.
Well, I'm looking at the 50th anniversary of Rolling Stone. It looks like one of the covers is like a photo collage of like some of the more famous photos that they've published over the years. And then there's a different one here. It says celebrating the 50th anniversary of rock, Rolling Stone. And it says the Immortals, the 50 greatest artists of all time. And, of course, they got Elvis, the Beatles, Jimi Hendrix, Janis Joplin, Kurt Cobain. Yep. So they just got kind of a collage of them there. So.
Eh.
Not necessarily the throwback.
Never heard of them.
Well, see, they did a bunch of them here because now another one is like the 50 greatest moments that changed the history of rock and roll. So they did a whole series there.
I think they should have done 50 different issues.
Right? 50 different covers for 50 different states.
No, 50 different issues, Greg. Like every single one has different articles.
Different stuff in them.
Yeah.
Actually, I mean, boy, that would be kind of neat, though.
I mean, I'm not going to shell out the like $250 bucks to get 50 issues of a
collect
magazine.
All 50.
Because all right. So if you're doing a weekly publication, that's a year's worth of publications.
Wow.
Anyway.
Okay. Well, anyways, this is an interesting one here. Moving on to the year 1993. Of course, we're on November 9th, but I didn't realize that both of these great hip hop and R&B legends debuted on the same gosh darn day. Who were they? Well, one of them was R. Kelly, and the other was the Wu-Tang Clan. Their debut albums both dropped on this day in 1993. And which one held up better? You decide. 12 Play or Wu-Tang's 36 Chambers? Well, honestly, depending on who you ask, is really the answer to that question, because I would probably say 36 Chambers is held in a much higher regard. But, you know, for R. Kelly fan, obviously, I think they would go the other way. So, what do you think?
I'll tell you what I think. Wu-Tang all the way, all day, any day.
Yeah?
Yes.
Because Wu-Tang Clan ain't nothing to mess with. Just kidding. No, but 36 Chambers is where we got the classic Cream. Cash rules everything around me. Cream, get the money. Dilla dilla bill, y'all. All right. Well, happy birthday to R. Kelly and Wu-Tang Clan's debut albums. And with that being said, we move on to our final day for this week in music history. And to the year 1938, we go!
November 10th, Kate Smith sings God Bless America for the first time in public. The song was actually written in 1918 by Irving Berlin, but it was cut from... Want to help me out here on
the review he was working on called Yip Yip Yap Hank?
That I guess. Look, that's just the information. I'm not an authority on how to say.
It was the year 1918. I feel like they called things Yip Yip Yap Hank. That was probably a real thing, right?
Well, that was a proto-USO review, right? So 1918, it's during the Great War, right?
Yeah.
And... Yeah, he wrote God Bless America. The words were slightly different. And then he thought, this just doesn't fit. Hmm. So, like, you know, Irving Berlin, the only talent, the only writer with enough talent to take the perennial God Bless America and just go, it's not good enough for Yip Yip Yap Hank.
Yeah. Yeah, this is not good enough for Yip Yip Yap Gang. This is my greatest endeavor ever. And God, and America just doesn't rise to the occasion.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. I can honestly say I've never even heard of Yip Yip Yap Hank, but I have heard of God Bless America. So it goes to show which one stood the test of time. Mm-hmm. Great. Yeah. Well, the year 1940. We got more info here, Jacob?
Here we go. This is my favorite story.
Is this the pick of the week?
Yeah, this is definitely the pick of the week.
Okay, settle in, folks. Grab your popcorn.
Because on this day, Screaming Lord Sutch was born David Edward Sutch in London, England.
Yay, happy birthday.
I know everyone in this room is going, who the hell is Lord Sutch? Lord Sutch was the founding member and sometimes only member of the official Monster Raving Loony Party. That is correct. Between 1963 and 1997, he lost 40 different elections.
Wow.
Lord Sutch began his onstage persona in early 1961. He sunk every penny of his earnings back into the performance, and by 1963, his horror rock show required more roadies than band members. He began each show with his band, the Savages, capturing him out of the audience, trapping him inside a black coffin. In the coffin, he would have a costume change, and the coffin would be carried on stage, and he would emerge as Jack the Ripper. In 1964, he started a pirate radio station called Radio Sutch, but after a year, he became bored with it and sold it to his manager, Reginald Calvert. Now, on June 21st, 1966, so 2 years later, Calvert was shot dead over a financial dispute involving the newly renamed Radio City. With Calvert's death, Sutch lost his only the only person in his life that called for any amount of normalcy.
Well,
yes. The Savages then became a revolving door of musicians with big names that were lining up to be part of the madness. In 1969, the album Lord Sutch and His Heavy Friends included such names as Jimmy Page, Jeff Beck, John Bonham, Noel Redding, Nicky Hopkins, and Kent Henry.
Wow.
Yes. Now, Sutch spent the 80s... because that's where we're at now. The 70s, they're best forgotten, even for Lord Sutch. But he spent most of the 80s playing shows, losing elections, and living at Cynthia Payne's house, who was England's most famous madam. He was living in a brothel.
He was living in a brothel?
He was living at a brothel, yes.
Okay.
Somehow, through all the controversy involving that brothel, he was never arrested.
No.
Can you believe it?
I mean, I get it. I get why you would live at a brothel, but how? Why?
Now, on June 16th, 1999, Sutch hung himself to death. He is survived by his son, Tristan Lord Quinn Sutch.
Wow. Well, that was really interesting. So, the guy is from England. he is a actor slash polit. So is he like a character running for office, essentially?
He is. What happened? He was Alice Cooper before Alice Cooper.
Okay.
And also the head of the official monster raving loony party.
Yes. Wow. Oh, okay. Well, politicians, I tell you.
I don't think there's a single level of British governance that he did not run for at one point.
Yeah.
And I believe the largest number of votes he ever had was 560-something.
Really?
Yes. However, they're pretty big sticklers for tradition and the way of doing things in England.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
So if you pay the fee to enter in as an official candidate, they are absolutely required to give you as much time as everyone else. And Lord Such would use that time however he saw fit. Maybe he was doing his nails. Maybe it was, you know, he...
like, it's almost like he's a stand-up comedian who uses his time to just do his show.
Yeah. Are you familiar with... There's a guy in the U.S. that's been doing this for years, and he always wears a galosh on his head.
Is that Vermin Supreme?
Yes, Vermin Supreme. He's kind of... So Lord Such was sort of Alice Cooper and Vermin Supreme all yeah. in one person.
Cool.
Making just the most beautiful corner in the history of everything.
Lord Such. Wait, why do they call him Screaming Lord Such?
I don't know!
Oh, okay. Well, damn. All right. Well, I don't like politics. So 1979, the Sugar Hill Gang enters the Hot 100 with Rapper's Delight. It's the first rap single to chart. Now, I remember last week we hit our first rap song to hit number one on the Billboard yes. Hot 100, Ice Ice Baby.
Ah.
Doom, 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 doom. Well, this was a few years before that. But so Sugar Hill Gang gets Rapper's Delight onto the charts, but it just didn't hit number one.
No.
So, well, that's great. And the Sugar Hill Gang, of course, changed the rap game for all eternity as well, too. It was probably, maybe a month ago, we did a longer segment about the Sugar Hill Gang and how they got started.
Yeah, and Mama Smith.
Right.
Mama.
Oh, yeah, because I think it was her birthday is why we were talking about it. Yep. So, anyways, jumping up a little bit now into the midst of MTV's heyday. The year was 1992, and the band was Ween. Their album, Pure Guava, is released by Elektra Records. The video for Push the Little Daisies gets some traction on MTV. Enough, I will say, for Beavis and Butthead to actually watch it and comment on it, saying, quote, these guys got no future. And I mean, nobody's heard of Ween, right? So maybe Beavis and Butthead were right. Just kidding. For 92, Ween was a big deal.
I mean, I guess that video was just... I don't know how to describe it.
Well,
pure confusion.
That's true. And Beavis and Butthead as the show kind of had like an interesting taste mm-hmm. in music because they were always watching like, it always seemed like the second or third single off an album was mm-hmm. always the one that they'd like catch on TV and make fun of.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's the first time Beavis and Butthead, I think that's the first time I ever experienced freaking Soundgarden, man.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's your first Soundgarden experience.
Yeah. I think it was Spoon Man was the video that they were making fun of. Of course, there's only one. I think it was a Stone Temple Pilots song. It's like the only one that I ever saw Beavis and Butthead with like, whoa, this is cool. But the rest, they're all just like, this is stupid.
They got no future.
Yeah. So, wow. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we have been doing this for almost a full hour now, which actually might make it one of our shorter episodes. Well, don't you think, Jacob?
I mean,
not half bad.
At least of the last like 6 months. Yeah,
yeah. This has been more of a sprint to the finish line tonight.
Love it.
But,
love it though.
With no Brian Croc, we don't have him to regale us with all of his great stories of travel and adventure. And
I predict that Jessica is going to love this episode.
She's, you know what I really liked about this episode?
You tore my husband down at every opportunity.
Oh, yeah, of course we did. Yeah. No, it's just his show. So if you're listening right now, Brian, thank you for letting us do the show, even though you should not have. So with all that being said, our last note for November 10th, the year 2007, we're heading to the country charts.
In 2007, this is kind of a rare thing. I don't think it's ever happened again, but the U.S. album charts, the top three were all country artists, and the late, no, not late, that's an incorrect word. At the time, Carrie Underwood was just starting her career after American Idol. This was in 2007. That was in 2005. She was on American Idol. So she was starting her career. She had number one
peaking
album. Yeah, she was peaking. That's a great term. Carnival Ride. And then number two was Alison Krauss and Robert Plant with Raising Sand. And number three, Gary Allen with Living Hard. Three country albums for the top three U.S. charts.
Wow. So, first time on the
country
US
was
album
a big
charts,
deal in 2007.
Topped, yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, country
goes in and out of phases, in my opinion.
Yeah, and you're right too. That's a good point with American Idol because Carrie Underwood, having just won American Idol, I mean, that show was the epitome of like pop culture at the time too. Mm-hmm. And so, if country was doing well on a totally like pop show, they just kind of brought it in with them. Alison Krauss, too, another great artist. So I'm not really surprised there. Of course, we love Alison Krauss around here.
She works with, she's done songs with Kenny Chesney, Brad Paisley.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, and she's from Central Illinois.
Is she?
She's from Decatur, Illinois.
Really? That's neat.
Yeah.
Did not know that.
It's fantastic. Only about, well, gosh, maybe an hour, 45 minutes, maybe 2 hours from St. Louis.
Yeah.
But, yeah, so good stuff. And,
yeah, at least that time around, it had like some talent, you know, opposed to those Garth Brooks, Dwight Yoakam years. Ooh. Those were rough.
Don't piss off the country fans now. We love.
No,
all
I'm not.
Of our
no,
music.
I'm just talking about Dwight Yoakam fans. I mean, come on now.
Come on now. What are you
come
doing?
On now.
What are you doing listening
seriously
to Dwight Yoakam?
Seriously, I mean, literally everything Dwight Yoakam's done, Marty Stewart has done better,
and you
including
can
quote the hair. Yeah, it's all right. You don't have to understand. Just it's funny. Trust me.
Oh, my
me.
Gosh. Like, when we went through that phase of 90s country and in denim.
Which phase of 90s country?
The denim phase.
The denim.
That's it. The denim. You know the denim phase. Everybody remembers the denim phase. If you don't remember the denim phase, either go to your own closet or at least your parents' closet and dig back to the part where there's the clothes that haven't been worn in a few years. Pull out that denim jacket.
That's it.
and just reach into the pocket and pull out that little piece of paper that says, you know, Garth Brooks and me forever. And just feel bad about it. So anyways, that concludes this week in music history, going from November 6th all the way to November 10th. And woo, what an exciting week it was. Boy, what was your favorite part, guys? Anything really? I mean, you know, so much great stuff happened, right? Yes?
Yes, I mean.
Okay, I'll go first. Ted Nugent kills a freaking squirrel from 150 meters.
Maybe.
With a bow.
Allegedly. With a bow. That's pretty darn good. Now, it's got to have been one of those super fancy bows. But, I mean, still, that's accuracy coming from a man who is, you know, a rock and roll player and, I guess, low-key a national squirrel shooting champion.
I mean, I adore degenerates. So, Alice Cooper, who starts his own political party and lives in a brothel.
I mean, Screaming Lord Such.
Yeah.
Oh, Lord Such. And I also learned today that, as far as we know, and I haven't tried Strange Donuts yet, but maybe we can go try some Strange Donuts and find ourselves.
Maybe we should just invent the peanut butter banana donut.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure it's out there somewhere.
Probably, yeah.
So, well, maybe we could just find it on Amazon and they'll send a drone.
Amazon has everything, so.
Yeah, they'll just drop donuts from the sky. That'd be great. Well, that's going to be it for us. Just a reminder, a lot of other great podcasts. You can find more This Week in Music History, album reviews, concert reviews, my top 10 countdown, and more. It's all at followthesoundpodcast.com. And while you're there, if you ever shop on Amazon, speaking of which, there's a little Amazon banner in the corner of our website. If you click on that and just do your regular Amazon shopping, it won't cost you anything extra, but they give us a little finder's fee, essentially, for you clicking through our website to do your Amazon shopping. So it helps the show, but it doesn't cost you anything extra. And if you do that, we really appreciate it. Don't forget to check out all the other great podcasts at lineupmedia.fm, including things like Armenia Nights and Armenia Proud, which Brian always talks about. There's also a great one called Surreal Talk. If you like blues hockey, chasing pucks with Panger, stuff like that. So you can find a lot of different podcasts to entertain yourself and eat away the hours of the day. lineupmedia.fm. With that being said, I'm in for Brian Crack today. I'm Greg Harvey, of course, our good friend Jacob Crum.
A pony-based economy is the most important issue in America today.
Exactly. And our guest for the night, Calamity Cole Duggar.
Yay!
Thank you. And with that being said, remember, folks, if you hear it, follow the sound.
This podcast was a presentation of lineupmedia.fm.